Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. On Tuesday night, most of the Republican presidential candidates met in Las Vegas for their eighth debate. 14 more are scheduled over the next few months. Things got kind of testy, especially between Mitt Romney and Rick Perry. Here's a sample of one of their arguments.
And Mitt, you lose all of your standing from my perspective because you hired illegals in your home and you knew about it for a year. And the idea that you stand here before us and talk about that you're strong on immigration is on its face the height of hypocrisy.
Governor Romney?
Rick, I don't think I've ever hired an illegal in my life. And so I'm afraid, I'm looking forward to finding your facts on that because that just doesn't.
I'll tell you what the facts are.
Rick, again,
you had the
Rick,
more, you,
I'm speaking.
Your newspaper,
I'm speaking.
The newspaper,
I'm speaking. I'm speaking.
It's time for you to tell the truth.
You get 30 seconds.
Time for you to
this is the way the rules work here is that I get 60 seconds.
Well, no, but the American
people
want the
truth. And then you get 30 seconds to respond, right?
And they want
Anderson,
to hear you say that you knew
would
you
please,
had
would you please wait?
Working.
Are you just going to keep talking?
Yes, sir.
Let me finish with what I have to say. Look, Rick.
This has
been a tough couple of debates for Rick, and I understand that. And so you're going to get testy.
And on it went. So are people watching the debates? Are they paying attention to the Republican race for the presidential nomination? Have they made up their minds? Are they changing their minds? How about you? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. We've asked Andy Kohut to join us. He's the president of the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. And Andy Kohut, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be with you, Marty.
So what did you make of Tuesday night's debate?
Well, it was pretty contentious.
It was.
And apparently, looking at the ratings, it's probably, like the previous debates, has drawn a pretty good cable audience. We find that even prior to this debate, about 27% of the public say they watched one of them. That's not as much as the 40% 4 years ago when two parties were having debates, but it's better than in 2004 when only the Democrats were having debates, which was 20%. So it's going pretty well, and it's not only from an audience point of view. It's not only Republicans are watching. While 36% of the Republicans are watching, 25% of the Democrats said they're watching, and 24% of the Independents. So it's attractive to people. Which is a measure of interest in this election generally, I think.
Well, you even found that about 60% of people have said that the debates have been helpful for them. Have you dug deeper in that to find out in what way?
Well, what we've seen is lots of ups and downs coming out of debates and straw polls in the Republican race. There's not much conviction about preferences, since we've seen various candidates arise and fall from Trump to Bachman and now Kane. But there's a fair amount of looking and shopping and saying, well, that might be my person. But so far, there's not preferences. The Republican preferences really haven't settled down. The only thing we can say for sure is that Romney's right in there, and there always seems to be an anti-Romney candidate, or an alternative to Romney, rather. And there's nothing solid about it. In fact, one of the things that we find, Marty, is that fewer people can name a Republican candidate than could 4 years ago. And in fact, I think one of the candidates, Rick Santorum, mentioned that just 50%. Could name one or more candidates in our poll 4 years ago. 45% could name Giuliani alone, not to mention all the others who were in the race. So the field is of interest to people, but it's kind of perplexing. People don't know what to make of it.
Well, there's a fair number of candidates. For instance, John Huntsman wasn't at that debate, but he is running. There are some other people that are also running that have or have not been included in some of the debates. Does that seem unusual? And these people, whether that's the, you know, the Godfather Pizza, Herman Cain, or some members of Congress, compared to someone like a Giuliani, who certainly had national recognition when he was running for president.
Well, there's not a lot known about them. And all of a sudden, a relatively small number of people within the Republican ranks will say, that person looks pretty attractive, and that we'll see at least for a period of time, their ratings go up in the polls. That was certainly true of Bachman, who seemed to be have a very viable candidacy a while back. It's going to take some time, and it usually does. You know, 4 years ago at this time, Rudy Giuliani was the first choice by far of Republicans in the national polls, and as we know, by the first or second week of or the first or second primary in 2008, he was pretty much out of the race, or never got into the race. And so we can't take it too far in terms of individual reactions, except to say there's a fair sense that Romney is the most electable candidate from the point of view of most Republicans and non-Republicans. But Republicans don't seem to want to settle on him. They want to explore other candidates. And there's some reasons for that we can talk about if you like.
Which I'd like to. But I'm also interested in, and Herman Cain has, you know, attached this 999 tax plan to his name. I don't know if that gives him name recognition. And I have to say the Tax Policy Center and others have done some pretty severe critiques of the 999 plan. But has that helped, you think, to give him the kind of popularity that he has today?
Well, certainly to find him. We did a poll this weekend with the Washington Post, and we asked, what one word would you use to describe Cain, Romney, or Perry? And the word, the phrase that they came up with Cain was 999.
Right,
the second word was business. The third word was interesting. Fourth word, good. And the fifth word, pizza. Now, for Mitt Romney, it was very different. Clearly, the number one word was Mormon. 60% said Mormon. For Perry, the number one word was Texas. So the 999 concept, for better or worse, in the long run, has come to be strong. Is Herman Cain's calling card.
And I know you don't take a position on the candidates, but it is interesting because Romney has been running for president for years now. Why he just has not been able to make more traction within the Republican Party? What do you think that reluctance is about?
Well, it has to do, I think, with the nature of the Republican Party. We do regular surveys about the values of Republicans and Democrats. And more than and this year, what we found is more than ever before, there's a very hardcore Republican, staunch conservative Republican base. 60-70% of them agree with the Tea Party, and they are conservative up and down the line. It's not a matter of their economic conservatives and social moderates or their social conservatives and economic moderates. I mean, they are strong conservatives, and these strong conservatives, I think, are really looking for someone who lights their fire. They're in a rebellious mood, and while Romney is, I think, the establishment candidate, he doesn't project that fire that some of these staunch conservatives are looking for, and I think they're the people that have dabbled with Bachman and now Cain. And even earlier, Trump.
At the beginning of the year,
Trump was doing pretty well in the polls before he took himself out of the race.
So these are the conservatives within the Republican Party that seem to be jumping from one of these, whether it's Michelle Bachman or now Herman Cain?
The more conservative, they're all conservatives because Republicans are largely conservatives, but the real staunch conservatives, it's my view that that's what's going on.
And what seems to be the driving issue this campaign season?
Oh, that's simple. Barack Obama. When we ask people who they would vote for if there was an election, would you vote for Obama versus Perry or Obama versus Mitt Romney? The people who say that they would choose Perry or choose Romney, we ask them why, and they say not because they're particularly basically for these other candidates, but because there's so much against Obama.
Oh, interesting. So he's a lightning rod.
Yes, he is. I mean, we've seen through his presidency a sharp rise in very conservative views about government, Republicans were energized and went out to the polls and scored a pretty big victory in 2010 because there was so much conservative frustration with Obama, and not only conservative frustration, but frustration among independents. These are tough times, and the president attracts a lot of people who don't think he's done a good job, and he also attracts a lot of people who think they don't like the course. They also don't like the course he's taken from an ideological point of view.
And he is the incumbent.
And most elections are presidential elections are referendums on the times.
I'm also looking at a study from the Pew Research Center looking at the tone of news coverage for all the candidates. And this goes from May 2nd to October 9th. So I'm not sure what's happened in the last, let's say, week or so. But nonetheless, Perry getting the most positive coverage when it comes to tone of the news, and President Obama getting the least positive coverage.
Yeah, two comments on that. First of all, if you look further into that study, you'll see in the most recent weeks, the tone of Perry's coverage has become negative.
Okay.
It's not as positive as it once was, but over that longer period, he has done better than the other Republican candidates. And the other thing with respect to Obama, a lot of the negative tone has to do with the fact that the reporting is reporting what the critics of Barack Obama are saying about them, and they're not saying nice things; they're saying negative things. And similarly, you see that the tone of Mitt Romney's coverage is also relatively negative. It's evenly divided between positive and negative. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he's the target in these debates and other campaign exchanges of a lot of criticism from people who want to knock him off his perch there.
And we're almost out of time for our segment here, but you're a veteran of campaign politics. Is there anything unique going on, or is this kind of politics as usual?
Well, what's unique is that we've got a very bad economic situation, and the public is really dispirited about national conditions. And that doesn't augur well for President Obama's re-election. But on the other hand, these Republican candidates, at least so far, many of them may seem a little bit out of the range of what independent voters might be willing to accept. So you know, we're likely to have a race.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Andy Kohut, thank you so much.
Well, you're quite welcome, Marty.
And he's the president of the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C., also director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Getting us started today in this hour of Radio Times as we take a look at the field of Republican candidates. And waiting in the wings, we have the New York Times, Matt Bai. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, it's Hungarian and Roma music from East Gypsy Band. Featuring saxophonist Tim Reese, East Gypsy Band fuses the traditions of Roma music with the improvisational characteristics of jazz. Beginning at 5:45, more details are available at philamuseum.org. The Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscowane. We cover politics on Radio Times a lot, and there's a lot of politics to discuss. Today we're putting the spotlight on the Republicans, the presidential candidates, the debates, the public's interest, and factions inside the GOP. I'm here to remind you that your support for WHYY allows us to bring you these in-depth discussions. If you've never been a member before, do it now by calling 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
How does where you are influence what you do? The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY and presents Here. an exhibition that looks at how the work of contemporary artists is saturated with the experience of where they live. On view October 22nd through December 31st, here showcases the work of 24 artists and artist collectives from 6 different regions of the country. For details, 215-972-7600 or PAFA.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the Republican Party as it settles on a presidential candidate. We began our conversation with Andy Kohut, head of the Pew Research Center that has been following the GOP presidential race. Joining us now is Matt Bai, chief political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, where he has covered both the 2004 and the 2008 presidential campaigns. He also writes the Political Times column that appears regularly in the caucus, and that's the Times blog on government and politics. It had a very interesting piece in this past Sunday's New York Times. And Matt Bai, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Boy, that was an enthusiastic hello from you, Matt Bai, too. That's okay. To our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And even before I get to your article, and I asked Andy Kohut the same thing, and I'm assuming you've been watching these Republican debates, what do you come away with? What have you learned so far?
What have we learned from the Republican debates? That there's too many of them. And that they're basically the same. I mean, look, I think this is a. I think what we've learned is that all these candidates have issues they have to work through. That it's a very volatile field. You'll notice that in the series of debates, if you look at them as a whole, it seems like every time the media accounts afterward are, focused on Cain. This one focused on attacking Perry. This one focused on attacking Romney. And that is an indication of how shifting the field is, how shifting the focus is, where it seems like every couple of weeks somebody else is the guy to beat or the guy to take down, and everybody's trying to figure out who's my competition. If there's only two slots here going into the voting season, you know, who's the guy I have to take down in order to be competitive. So I think for this stage of the race, where you would normally be in a presidential campaign, and this is my fourth as a reporter, I think it's unusually unsettled in terms of figuring out who is well positioned and who's going to go into the voting season with advantages in different states, except for the fact that I think it's pretty clear at this point that Mitt Romney is both the establishment favorite, and I think now, as opposed to what I would have said 3 or 4 months ago, I think an established front runner in the field and certainly the guy to beat for any of the other candidates.
How do you think he's been able to position himself then as front runner?
Well, I think a lot of it's default, frankly. I think he's never been quite the natural front runner that Republican voters are used to. He wasn't a clear leader among the runner-ups last time around. He's not beloved by the base of the party. He's not especially well-known to Republicans nationally. So he never really enjoyed the kind of position that a Bob Dole or a John McCain, even a George W. Bush had in 2000, where everybody was clearly rallied around him. But I think the inability to recruit another candidate, particularly for establishment Republicans who they could get behind and who the fundraisers could get behind, the very unsteady entry of Rick Perry into the race, again, Chris Christie saying he's not going to get in just a few weeks ago, I think all of those things have sort of broken Romney's way, and now you see the establishment here in Washington and elsewhere sort of swinging behind him, the money guys coming on board. So I think Romney has gotten much, much better as a candidate from 4 years ago and even from several months ago. I think he's really honed his message. I think he's performed well in the debates. But having said that, I think the factors that have mostly led him to a position on top of the field have been outside of his control.
And today, who is an established Republican? What does it mean to be an establishment Republican?
Well, it sort of depends who you ask. I mean, as I talked about in Sunday's magazine piece, that's a different concept to different people. There are a lot of Republicans who will tell you there is no more establishment, that was sort of the white shoe lawyers and bankers of the Nixon-Rockefeller era, and it kind of went away in 1964 and was completely shattered in 1980 and doesn't exist. I think you would have to say that there's a more complex establishment, but it does exist. And there are really several sub-establishments. There's media, and there's social conservatives and economic conservatives and fundraisers. But I think at the heart of all this is, in Washington at least, is a real establishment that's really centered on the money, the people who are involved in the business of government, the lobbyists, the consultants in regulatory policy, the lawyers, the fundraisers, the people who derive their living from the business of government and the business of campaigns, they are still a very cohesive, powerful establishment who can wield a lot of money and a lot of organization behind a candidate when they cohere. And I think in recent weeks only, they've done that around Mitt Romney.
And how, looking within the party, which is certainly what your article does, though, but how does this group of people, as you say, well-heeled, wanting a candidate that can win in a general election, how do they deal with the so-called Tea Party or the anti-government Republicans, especially those that have come into office?
Well, they've obviously, you know, it's been a difficult year for those kinds of Republicans. It's a difficult time to be an establishment of anything in America. Ask people who own, you know, department stores or publishing houses or record labels. It's not an easy time to be an entrenched power in American society. And for Democrats went through this quite a bit in 2004, 2005. I wrote a book about it. And it certainly has affected Republicans since the onset of the Tea Party, and it's been a very destabilizing time. But I think their feeling is that the Tea Party's been a net positive in the sense that it's brought a lot of energy and voters to the polls, helped them achieve the power they have in Congress in 2010, and that really the moment that the establishment always reasserts itself in Republican politics traditionally is in the season of a presidential campaign and then should you win in the filling out of an administration. So they're very optimistic at this point. They feel like they have a lot of grassroots energy. They feel like they have economic indicators and favorability polls, as Andy Cohut is talking about, that make it very hard for President Obama to glide to re-election. And they feel that once they get into this process of having a nominee, provided that person isn't, you know, say a Michelle Bachmann or a Herman Cain, but is someone like Mitt Romney, once they get a nominee, once they fill out the campaign roles, once they get an administration, should they win the White House, that this is when the establishment reasserts its control, and that the Tea Party phenomenon is essentially already waning. I'm not sure they're right about all that, but that is how they're seeing the moment.
Because it seems to me, from a Republican perspective, though, if you look at the popularity of those candidates, whether it's Herman Cain or Bachmann or Perry, those are not establishment candidates, and yet those so far are the ones that seem to generate the most interest and enthusiasm.
Well, I think it's a real question about Rick Perry. I mean, the assumption in Washington, right or wrong, is that Romney and Perry are the two likeliest nominees still. And Perry, you know, don't forget, despite his anti-Washington rhetoric and the states' rights stuff and the secessionist business and whatever else, you know, this is a guy who's been a three-term governor of Texas and a head of the Republican Governors Association. He has ties to some of the top fundraisers in Washington. So he's not at all the anti-establishment figure that he might make himself out to be. And I think there's a feeling in Washington that, hey, if Perry were the nominee, we'd work with him. We'd get enough. We'd be inside the door. We'd have enough interaction. You know, he's not going to be a guy who runs the kind of radical campaign that you might get from a Michelle Bachmann or Ron Paul or Herman Cain. Having said that, I just think it's a different moment than, you know, the sort of political insurrections Republicans have experienced in the past. I don't think this is just a normal cycle. Movements are different. Establishments are different. Technology is different. And I think it's harder to control the agenda, control the public image of a party than it used to be. And I think the sense that the establishment has right now that, you know, come next year when they have a nominee and they're in the campaign season, they will be able to rebrand the party in a sense and push the Tea Party activists off to the margin so as to appeal to independent voters and moderate voters. I think that may be a little wishful. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be considerably harder to get control of the party's image and message than it has been in the past.
Your article begins with some analysis looking at President Obama and finding that he's vulnerable because of something called consumer confidence. And I realize that your article is based on several different interviews and perspectives on the Republican Party and also on the president himself. But does the party, I mean, I guess it's their job to see him as vulnerable, but do they see him as vulnerable?
Well, I did dozens of interviews, just to be clear, with Republicans in Washington and outside. And I don't think you could walk down a street here and find a Republican or a Democrat who doesn't think the president is particularly vulnerable. I would be swimming heavily against the current at this point to suggest that the president enjoys an extreme advantage. I don't think he's finished at this point. I mean, I think this is a very open question. But if you look at the economic data, I think what Bill McInturk, the Republican pollster, and this is the study you were referring to, I think what he reports based on University of Michigan data is that no president has ever won re-election when that consumer index falls under 75, and at the moment, I think it's in the 50s, and so it's lower than where Jimmy Carter was at this time prior to his re-election bid that failed in 1980. So, you know, I think based purely on economic conditions in the country and consumer confidence in the data, you would have a hard time thinking that President Obama had, you know, was an odds-on favorite for re-election. I will hasten to add, though, Marnie, that you know that when I was in 2004, when I was going around talking to people, I mean, I saw Democratic operatives give presentations talking about how no president with George W. Bush's economic data had ever managed to get himself reelected, and he did. So I do think this is a fundamentally different moment. I don't think historical analogies are useful and informative, but not binding in any way.
And that's Matt Bai, chief political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. And we're talking about politics and the Republican Party. And he had a very interesting piece in the Sunday New York Times Magazine looking at the GOP. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. It sounds from your piece, Matt, that looking within the Republican Party, that the establishment Republicans want to, in a sense, co-opt the Tea Party people, and the Tea Party people want to co-opt the establishment Republicans. Is there a wrestling match going on inside the GOP?
There is, Marty. I mean, I think it's I think it's a question, as you say, of who's co-opting who here. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, the traditional narrative here is that the Republican establishment, we can stipulate that the term that it still exists,
right,
sort of absorbs and assimilates the, you know, outsider or grassroots movements. I mean, you had the movement conservatives of the Goldwater years, the Reagan years, the evangelical conservatives. I mean, we forget how turbulent Republican politics have been. We tend to think of it as fairly homogeneous, but look, in the late 1970s, there were still liberal Republicans. Remember that? I mean, they're gone. They were. You know, they knocked off a couple of incumbent senators in the late 1970s and 1978 prior to Ronald Reagan's victory, and that was a huge moment, a sort of grassroots uprising, and you know that movement sort of became the establishment. So I think there's a sense that this is just like those waves, and that in effect the Tea Party will become establishment figures, and the people who seem like insurgents today will be lobbyists and think tank heads 10 years from now. But I think this is a very different movement for a couple of reasons. I mean, just off the top of my head, very quickly. One, this is not an internecine fight. We're not talking about liberal wing versus conservative wing. We're not talking about one group of officials versus another. These are people who haven't even belonged to the party, largely, who haven't been part of the process. So very hard to co-opt people who aren't seeking the same goals of power and governance that you are. And then the other thing is it's a leaderless movement in the way of internet-based movements everywhere, of modern movements like the movement that sprung up on the left on the blogs and Move On several years ago. There's no one to sit down with and negotiate with here. There's no one who you give a job to or who makes enough money that they can bring a whole bunch of other people along. This is a very decentralized, grassroots-based movement. It's very hard to co-opt activists. Mm.
Well, and people that truly believe in limited government, for instance.
Yeah, well, they believe what they were told. I mean, this to me is one of the great ironies, and sort of part of the silliness here is that the establishment guys will sit around and say to you, and I talk about this in the piece, they seem mystified. How could anyone be so nihilistic in their impulses? How could anyone think that government does nothing good? I mean, how do we get these folks to think about pragmatism and compromise? And as I point out, and I've pointed out to them in my interviews, that's because you told them this. For 20 or 30 years, Republicans have been campaigning on very facile language and very deep-seated resentment toward government, on this idea that government, as Ronald Reagan put it, is not the solution, it is the problem. And there is a cost for that, which is that generations of people have now grown up, if they're conservatively inclined, believing that and taking it in many cases to its extreme, to the point where people who've benefited from those kinds of campaigns for many years now find themselves in the very awkward and uncomfortable position of trying to defend certain government roles and government programs. I mean, you have Michelle Bachmann standing on stage in a Republican debate, asked the question, how much of the dollar should we take for federal taxes? And her answer is none. I don't think anybody should pay federal taxes for anything. By the way, she wants to build a fence. She said the other night she wants more defense spending. She just doesn't want to pay for it. And that, you know, this is the consequence of many, many years of telling people that they can have all the things they feel the country needs, but they shouldn't have to pay for any of it.
But it's nonsensical, but it does seem to resonate.
Well, it's not entirely nonsense. I mean, I don't want to be too dismissive because, you know, is government wasteful in some sense? Yes. Should government be modernized? Probably. Are entitlement programs a long-term threat in terms of the long-term budgetary picture of the country? I think it's very hard to argue that they are not, given the demographic trends in the country. So, although some people certainly will. So I don't think it's entirely unhealthy to look at the structural budget issues that are faced in Washington and try to bring a new mentality to it. I'm not suggesting that they're wrong about everything, but to take that to the extreme and essentially say we shouldn't be collecting any taxes, but we shouldn't be losing any of our core missions, and nothing government does is useful, and no penny that it spends that isn't on defense is worth spending. Obviously, that's not a way to run a government, and I think the Republicans who really have profited from that message for many, many years in its you know, most reductive form understood that and have largely been more nuanced in the way they've approached it in Washington, which is why we have, say, a prescription Medicare benefit, which is among the most expensive social programs in the history of the country, passed by a Republican president, a Republican Congress. But I think they didn't communicate that to their own activists and their own voters, and now they find that facility with language, that simplicity of the message, makes it a lot harder to grapple with forces inside their own party.
And is that what House Speaker John Boehner has been, in a sense, grappling with as he deals with members in the House?
Yeah, Boehner's a great example, right? He was a young rebel. He was one of these guys, like the Newt Gingriches of the world, who wanted to radically reduce the size of government, who told people that no tax was good, that no tax made sense, that you could radically restructure. I mean, I think now he finds himself in the position of trying to convince some segment of his caucus that, you know, there is discretionary spending worth defending, and also that you can't actually restructure the budget through discretionary spending. And that's a fifth of the federal budget. That if you actually want to restructure spending in America through in the federal sector, you're going to have to look at sort of long-term and embedded programs, these entitlement programs that are very unpopular to talk about reforming. You got to do something like Paul Ryan wants to do, and then you have to go out and tell people in your district that you're going to cut their Medicare or you're going to cut their Social Security, and you can't beat up the president for trying to control Medicare costs. And that's a much more complex case than to run around just saying, well, we'll just cut waste and fraud and everything will be fine. And so, yeah, he has a hard job.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Matt Bai is our guest. He's chief political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine. In fact, had a very interesting piece in last Sunday's magazine about the Republican Party. And he also writes the Political Times column and appears regularly in the caucus. And that's the Times blog on government and politics. We like to talk about politics on Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Also, opening up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. We've been covering a fair amount of territory here. We'd love to get your response. Again, 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
MacArthur Theater Center in Princeton supports WHYY and presents Fedra Backwards, a new work by Irish playwright Marina Carr, now through November 6th. The mythic and the modern collide in a lyrical new adaptation of the classic Fedra myth that explores the pull of fate, the labyrinth of legacy, and the danger of desire. Contains adult themes. Tickets at 609-258-2787 or at MacArthur.org.
I'm Marty Moscowen. We cover politics on Radio Times a lot, and there's a lot of politics to discuss. Today, we're putting the spotlight on the Republicans, the presidential candidates, the debates, the public's interest, and factions inside the GOP. I'm here to remind you that your support for WHYY allows us to bring you these in-depth discussions. If you've never been a member before, do it now by calling 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
3GreatSchools.org supports WHYY. The Haverford School, the Agnes Irwin School, and the Baldwin School. This mainline trio of single-sex college preparatory day schools are dedicated to leveraging what other schools cannot, the distinct ways boys and girls think and learn. Open house dates from October 23rd through November 2nd. Details at 3GreatSchools.org. 3 Great Schools, leading the way in single-sex education.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with the New York Times Matt Bai about politics, Washington politics, the Republican Party, the race for the White House. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Matt, how does the party establishment, we're using that word as a kind of a shorthand, how do they view someone like Ron Paul?
Well, as a nuisance, I think, and as kind of a crazy person, honestly. I mean, there's a, and I don't say this facetiously. I talked to a lot of Republicans here when I was doing this piece. One, who I quote in the piece, refers to it as the Ron Paul problem. That's the problem that the party has. They see the Ron Pauls of the world as, not good for the image of the party, as seeming marginal, conspiratorial, black helicopter crowd, the Fed is no good, the federal government is no good. I mean, they see him as kind of a crank. I mean, to be clear, both parties have this and have had it. There's always somebody on the margin who the establishment of either party finds, embarrassing in some way, or at one time or another, both parties seem to be dealing with that. I think, in a sense, Ron Paul is less of an issue for them because his support is pretty defined and he's been around for a while, and everybody knows that he sort of stakes out a conviction but isn't terribly practical about it. I think that's a different thing from, where Sarah Palin would be if she's hovering around, or even a Michelle Bachmann, or even at this moment a Herman Cain, somebody who, might prevent a more extremist version of the party but in a palatable way that appeals to a lot of independent voters and frustrated voters who aren't necessarily ideologues.
Let me get, looks like Linda from Princeton to join us on Radio Times. And Linda, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have a question for Matt regarding John Huntsman.
Sure.
He was someone who, when he quit his position in China, it seemed that the Obama administration was very afraid of him getting into the race, and his candidacy does not seem to have taken any traction, and he seems like such a viable candidate. So I'm wondering what Matt has to say about that.
Now, Linda, thanks for calling in. Matt, go ahead.
That's a good question, Linda, and I, you're probably not aware, but I wrote, a big long piece about him. I was with him on his very first trip back and wrote a long piece in the magazine about him, and, you're right. He seemed like a big deal, and his campaign has gone absolutely nowhere, and he's in deep debt and has had problems. I'll qualify that in a moment, that he's gone nowhere, but for the purposes of answering your question, to this point, he's really gone nowhere. Why is a question? You would get a lot of people who would tell you, John Huntsman's gone nowhere because he's too moderate and the party's too extreme and there's just no market for his ideology. I've always been less inclined that way. I think the party is more diverse than people think it is in terms of ideology, and certainly in some early states, notably New Hampshire, more independent-minded moderate Republicans have done very well. I think the problem for Huntsman is he had a window of time in which the whole world was looking at him and thought he could be a serious candidate, and he had nothing to say. And that window closed. And I actually think he's gotten to be a better candidate, and he's honed his – he's gotten more acclimated now back in the country on the campaign trail. And if he were debuting today, it would probably be a different story. But that window only opens for so long when you're the new thing in the race. And he really didn't seem to know why he was running or what kind of candidate he wanted to be. And he still struggles, I think, to define himself. Now, he hasn't had particularly good debate performances either. Now, having said all that, I did see yesterday, I wasn't there, but I heard he had a few hundred people at a town hall in New Hampshire. He's banked his entire campaign in New Hampshire. If you looked back at October of other cycles in New Hampshire, you would find that, say, John McCain in 2000 was not by any means the leader in New Hampshire at this point in time. He was probably just breaking into double digits, and then ultimately, of course, won in a landslide. So it's a volatile state in a volatile field. And so I'm not ready to say, you know, John Huntsman at 2% nationally is finished, because the national polls are less important than what he can do in that state where he's banked his campaign. But I certainly think, he's a real long shot at this point, having, I think, failed to grasp the moment that was given him.
Linda, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Matt, do you think there's an appetite for a third party, whether coming from, you know, the Republican or disaffected Republicans or even disaffected Democrats?
Well, Marty, I have very specific thoughts on this, having talked about the failure of the two-party system for a very long time in my work, to many people's consternation, which is I don't think Americans have any interest in a third party. I think there would be no end of interest for a strong independent candidate, and that's not a simple rhetorical difference. That's a real difference. I think the whole movement right now, the reason that people are so disenchanted, is because we are a much more anti-institutional culture, and younger voters are less affiliated with parties, and I think they don't like the idea of belonging to one party and having to sign off on an ideology and on a slate and a ticket. And I think, you know, introducing another party into the mix, as some people have tried to do lately and always, is not going to be successful, because people don't want to join things. They don't want to be affiliated in that way. But I think that same culture creates a huge avenue for an individual who would step forward, who would be a credible candidate with name recognition, who could raise money on the internet. I think all the barriers to an independent candidacy are much lower than they used to be, and the only thing keeping that from completely disrupting the status quo of our politics is the lack of that particular candidate. I don't know who that person would be, and I think at some moments you have it, at some moments you don't. But if you looked at Ross Perot in 1992, or even someone like Colin Powell, considered very strongly, I think, running in 1996, and you said, as an independent candidate, give one of those guys the internet and the moment, and I think you could easily see one of those guys coming in second, if not first, in a presidential campaign. And I think if the frustration level in the country continues anywhere near where it is and where it has been more or less for a long time, the notion of an independent presidency is not only quite possible, but I would argue probably inevitable.
And interesting, I mean, the right person without a party, you think, could do pretty well. Well, I guess Ross Perot did. He was a very wealthy man. I don't know if that's ancient history.
Yeah.
But the right person without a party could do well.
I think so. It probably takes either some wealth or name recognition or a combination of both. And I think you have to be credible in the sense that, you know, having served or at least led something large. So, again, I don't really see that person out there. I guess some people have talked about Mayor Bloomberg. He may be the closest thing out there right now. But I'll tell you, I absolutely do. I think, you know, the barriers to an independent candidacy have always been money and exposure and ballot access. And none of those things in the internet age are nearly as formidable as they once were. I mean, Barack Obama showed you could raise all your money, or a lot of money, over the internet, certainly enough to be competitive. The media is much more diverse, and you can do a lot more for less money online. And ballot access, you know, can really be solved through, again, through organizing people online, activists, who you can get to instantly in many different states. So I think those, you know, the traditional things that make people roll their eyes and say, we're a two-party country, it's never going to change, I don't think that's the case anymore. But I think people who think they can make a difference, make a dent in the system as it exists by creating another party, are really missing the point of where society is headed.
Let me ask about something, and this is the cover story actually in Time magazine, The Return of the Silent Majority, but they did some interesting polling finding that something like 89% believe that politicians should compromise on major issues like the deficit rather than take a hard line. I'm quoting from Time. Nearly three quarters think there should be higher taxes for millionaires. Only 11% identify themselves as supporters of the Tea Party. 25% say that they are angry, and 75% describe themselves as merely upset or concerned about the country, which raises, if that's all true, which raises questions about whether, and since we're talking about the Republican Party, whether they're sort of out of step with the majority of the American people.
Well, you know, I'm sure all that data is right, and I think it represents something important. But if public opinion polling were on one issue or another were the driver in understanding where politics was headed, then we would have a ban on handguns in this country. Marty, you could take any poll in the last 20 years, and a majority of Americans, a vast majority, will tell you there should be increased regulation on guns. 80% of Americans or something in any given poll will tell you that common sense regulations on guns should be adopted tomorrow. And no law has ever been able to pass in Washington except for the Brady Law, except for the, with one exception during the Clinton years. In, 30 years, we've not been able to make a dent in regulating handguns in the country. Why is that? Well, it's because in a vacuum, those numbers seem to be very indicative of something strong, but politics isn't about a vacuum. Politics is about, A, conflicting priorities. What do you care about most? What is a candidate saying that's most important to you? And also about trade-offs that want compromise, but then when you see the compromise, it's, wait a minute, you want to cut my Social Security, or you want to raise the retirement age, or you want to cut defense spending, or, you know, this is a, you know, you see this also in polls, that when you ask people, what are you willing to give up, the answer is always nothing. So I think all of that points to an important impulse in the American public, which is that they want to be led. They understand there are choices that are going to have to be made. They understand that pragmatism is important, and they want someone to give them a clear sense of what choices, difficult choices, they need to make. But unless they're led, and unless somebody has a plan and can make a sustained and a strong argument, and actually tell the truth in a way that's both courageous and persuasive, I don't think anything's going to change. Because, and so, you know, are the Republicans out of step with, well, you know, yes, on a bunch of issues, and this is always true. I mean, Democrats are always saying, how did we lose the election? They're with us on every issue. But it's because it depends on who the messenger is and what that message is and what's most important to people at the moment. And I think in terms of this spending and in terms of government being reckless and out of control, I think Republicans and the Tea Party are very much in step with where a lot of Americans are. And that has been sort of the dominant impulse that enabled them to take back Congress or the House in 2010, and it's going to make them competitive in 2012 regardless.
But you did interview some Republicans for this article that said, look, we didn't like Bush spending as much as he did, and the deficits going up under his administration, but they didn't speak out.
No, that's right. Well, that's true. I mean, look, they were... The Republican Party is pretty hierarchical and values loyalty. And so, yes, there are a lot of establishment Republicans who sat through the Bush years and tried to go along and get along and were not happy over Iraq and were not happy over deficits. And for those people, they welcome the advent of the Tea Party because they see it as bringing renewed focus and energy to the issues they sort of cared about to begin with, which is the changes in the... Changes in the spending structure in Washington. Unfortunately, they're frustrated because these same Tea Party folks who brought that energy are refusing to compromise on anything, don't want a dollar of taxation anywhere, and only want to focus on short-term spending instead of sort of the long-term structural spending that's actually more difficult to get your head around. So I think, you know, there is an opportunity. There's absolutely an opportunity to find some kind of compromise that would change the trajectory of the country, both in terms of investment and tax reform and spending. I mean, in that sense, we shouldn't be quite so pessimistic. I mean, the president and the Speaker of the House started a conversation that did not end at that point in any kind of serious compromise, but could well in the months or years ahead. But it is going to take more leadership than anybody's been willing to show, and I think that gets to the point you're making.
And that's Matt Bai. He's chief political correspondent for the New York Times Magazine and covers politics, elections, and we are talking about all of that today on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane, and you're listening to WHYY.
And that, oh yes, this is the voice of doom. No,
wow, that was an interesting
boy.
Effect.
That got your attention now, didn't it? Now, this is the real honest Ed Cunningham with a real honest Debbie Builder, asking for your support in a non-vibrational sort of way at 1-888-345-9499 and online at whyy.org. I just love listening. I love talking politics. Mm-hmm. I love listening to political talk. And where better to listen to a Debbie Builder than right here at WHYY? And the great thing about it, as we keep pointing out, it's not coincidental that this program is as excellent as it is, and the fact that it's on public radio, because you, the listener, give Marty and her guests the time to talk about things from every possible angle you can think of. You give them that time because of the support you make that makes our commercials not important on WHYY. So if you like that, here's a number to support it, 1-888-345-9499, the web address, whyy.org.
Yeah, I can't, you know, I don't know about you, Ed, but I can't understand what these complicated issues, these complicated ideas in 2 minutes, 3 minutes, or a sound
bite. Right.
It's so nice to have an hour to get deep into an issue, to look at it, to analyze it, to get the context you need to really understand it. And that's what Radio Times does, 2 hours every weekday. If you value that, give us a call right now. Show your support for this show, for what Marty Moscowain does, at 1-888-345-9499. Again, 1-888-345-9499.
Now, what's Debbie, I just wanted to ask, I think it's germane to this discussion, the size of the staff for Radio Times. Marty does obviously a great deal of research, and you can't find a more well-versed person in as many topics as you can in Marty. But, I mean, she's got you folks working for her. There's several of you, right?
Right, right. There are four of us. She's four producers and a couple great interns. And we help her put together these programs. You know, at the end of every hour, we hand her these two big files for tomorrow's show, and she goes through and pours through all the research and starts putting together the hours for the next day.
So this is a serious operation. The same certainly could be said for Fresh Air, of course, with Tariq Rose. This is the kind of infrastructure that your support for this kind of excellence in radio has built over these last number of years. You're celebrating 25 years,
that
right?
This coming year.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great, Debbie. Well, you well deserve it. Certainly one of our pride and joy programs on WHYY Radio Times, and I know you feel the same way, not only as a listener, but as a listening member. 1-888-345-9499. Debbie, I just love this WHYY eco-friendly shopping bag that you pointed out very properly. You can put a whole bunch of books in there.
Yeah.
So when you're going home to do some research, use that shopping bag. It's made out of this canvas that can hold a whole bunch of stuff. You decide what you want to put in it. And it's deep and it's great and it saves landfills if you use it to go to the grocery store. Available to you, $75 pledge at 1-888-345-9499 or online at WHYY.org. And for somebody who likes to follow events like you and your staff, Debbie, I love the fact that if you use your credit card, Visa, MasterCard, American Express, or Discover, you can ask for Newsweek magazine for a year.
Right, right. All different choices you get. And with Radio Times, that's how it is, too, because we cover so many different